I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. Welcome, everybody, to Spark My Muse. Today, my guest is Carol Howard Merritt, and she is an author, a speaker, and a minister. And today, we're going to be talking about When the Church Has Hurt You, which is the topic of her book, Healing Spiritual Wounds, Reconnecting with a Loving God After Experiencing a Hurtful Church. Thank you so much, Carol, for being my guest today.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
As I was reading your book, I was definitely surprised by not just the topics within it, but your own personal story. And we can talk a little bit about how the book is laid out, because it's a great book for people who have been hurt by the church. And there's exercises within it to help people process and work through things. Very, very helpful exercises for people to look introspectively and deal with a lot of things in a very personal, rich way. But also, you open up a lot of your own story and a lot of your very fundamentalist background. And that's something I didn't know about you going into it. I had really only known about you in more of a superficial way, that you are on the progressive end of the spectrum, and you have written about ministry and ministering to younger generations. And so what made you decide to kind of delve deep into your past like that and expose it in such a way?
Yeah, it's such a different way to face the world, right? So I've always faced the world as the church expert who has it all figured out. And then all of a sudden, you know, I'm facing the world as, hey, I was abused. And that's just a really different position to be taking, and a different way of negotiating the writer-reader relationship. And I guess one led to the other, because, you know, whenever you're working with church consulting stuff and church coaching, you're always, you know, there's always this lingering question right now, and that is why. Why aren't millennials going to church? Why are the nuns the largest group or the religious group, quote unquote, I guess, that's growing the most? You know, people who don't believe in religion, and so there's always people trying to answer that question. And I would just sit back and say, hey, I know how to answer that question, because, you know, there's just so many of us wounded. And so, I just felt like I was working on these surface issues, and we needed to go deeper. And there's a lot of people doing really wonderful work on this, and there's so many people who just kind of came out with healing spiritual wounds type books all at the same time. And I think that's just in response to this longing to connect with people and to understand this deeper need. So yeah, that's it. Like, I'm always working in the world of demographics, and this is how you can tell your story, and this is how you can present your church to the world in a better way, and this is what we can do. And I just really felt like we weren't getting to the heart of the matter. We weren't getting to the real wounds that people were feeling.
Our stories parallel a little bit, and I'm not going to get into my story because this is a show about you. But one of the things that people have said to me when I wind up sharing things about my fundamentalist and kind of abusive church background and abusive parent background relating to religion is, why are you still a Christian? Like, why would you even still be a Christian when it's been so toxic? And the implied messages and the overt messages are extremely destructive and take away your personhood and really are demeaning and degrading. And I have, of course, my own answers to that. But throughout your book, you talk about a lot of the toxicity within your home having to do with Christianity and fundamentalism in particular, but also where you went to a Bible school. And it just seems like, and then here you are, a minister, and mm-hmm. you are really, in a sense, still on the team. And do people ever say, why did you stick with it? Or why does this still mean something to you? And what gave you a heart to stay with the system, in a sense, and not, you're still in it, and people come to you and gravitate towards you with their stories, and they still want to be a part of things too. And I guess you can see a common pattern there as well.
Yeah, it's something. It's because I ask myself that question a lot. Actually, the reason why I wrote the book is because I had a friend who is Jewish and agnostic, and she, I told her a little bit about my background. She just kept asking, "Well, why are you a minister?" And it was the first time that somebody was asking me that, not in a hurried way or not as part of some sort of ordination exam, but in an honest, curious sort of way. And I didn't feel like I had to defend the church. I didn't feel like I had to, defend my calling into ministry, but I could just kind of tell the truth. And so I told her this story that I tell in the first chapter of the book, and that's this time when I was a teenager. I think I was about 15, and I could hear my parents yelling down the hall, and I could hear the dishes clanging, and I could hear just the rising and cresting of this argument that was happening. And I remember just trying to figure out how I was going to escape. You know, could I go to a neighbor's home? Could I go to a friend's home? How was I going to get out? And then I sat on the bed, and I just kept asking, what should I do? What should I do? What should I do? And then I started praying, God, what should I do? What should I do? What should I do? And I sat on the bed, and it was just like this incredible peace flooded me. And it's something, there's so many things in the book that are hard to describe. And so I'm describing them with metaphors and, just trying to as much as I could. But it was such a palpable feeling. It felt like an epidural, it felt like pain and then peace. And it really, the experience marked me. And it made me realize that even though so much of what was going on in our home was violent and was abusive, it marked me with this sense that there's something about the spiritual life, something about my connection with God, something about these things that also give me incredible peace. And so I guess I just, from then on, was always exploring, what is that life-giving stream? So there is a lot of toxic things about Christianity. There's no way to read a history book without acknowledging that. But at the same time, there's also this life-giving abundant stream that's running right alongside with that toxicity. So how do we do that? How do we drink from that life-giving stream and while saying, hey, this river is toxic, this stream is toxic. And so that's sort of been my goal in life and in my ministry, is just trying to squeeze out as much of the love as I can from this great religion and this great tradition, while fully acknowledging the difficulties of it.
As I was reading, I was thinking a lot about the kind of religious culture that we're we can be born into and that we sort of ingest along the way. We don't really know. This goes for anybody in any tradition. I mean, I've often thought about if I had been born in, you know, Iran or somewhere else, I would have ingested a different culture and a different religion, most likely, and I wouldn't have known any better. You know, I would have been born in a different context. And of course, the context I was born in, my parents met in a fundamentalist Baptist seminary. So I didn't have much of a choice. I was very, very happy to know and pray to Jesus from a very early age. And we think about, it's only with a little bit of perspective, we can think about some of the thoughts we had about God, that we don't even know that we have, and we're just ingesting these thoughts about God. And a lot of them are very closely associated with our parents and this practical theology that we wind up living out, and our parents are living out their own because of their parents and so on, and other authority figures, and thinking about, you know, what is God really like? Is God really punitive? Is he angry? Is he watching for us to screw up? Or is he more like Santa? what is this cultural, religious context that we're born into, that we imbibe, and then being able to somehow stand away from it and look back onto it. I mean, we never totally can, really, but right. As we get a little older and see other people with other thoughts and other experiences, we can kind of get a sense. Now, when was that kind of obvious to you? Was it in college that you thought, oh, maybe there's other ways to see God, maybe there's other things going on, where maybe God doesn't look one way?
Yeah, there was this, there were so many times in college, because even though I went to a very strict Bible school, they had a library with a lot of different viewpoints, and mainly because I think I'm not sure. I think it was a bit like an apologetical, like we needed to learn the other viewpoints in order to be able to uphold ours and defend the faith against the heresies. So, and also we were really close to University of Chicago, their Div School, and the consortium there. And so I would often go to these bookstores that were in the consortium near the University of Chicago, and just scour the theology sections. And so I became exposed mostly to like liberation theology, a little bit to feminist theology, but it just opened up this whole other world of struggle, and I began to just realize that this construction, this metaphor of God that I carried around with me, was just that. It was a construction. It was a metaphor. It was one that was deeply tied to particularly my father. It was one that was very white. It was very tied to this idea that God and America were somehow intertwined, God and country. It was very colonialistic sort of God. And so it was through reading, mostly reading, that I was able to be introduced to other perspectives. I did have this experience, like my last year in seminary. I mean, I'm sorry, my last year in Bible school. And it like hit me that I was not going to be able to still be a Christian if I stayed in this faith. And the thing was, you know, since it was a very conservative Christian background, there was a lot of shunning that was used among my friends. And I was just scared to death that my parents would shun me and my family would shun me. So I was, and there still was a little bit of that, but I was just so scared about that. And I just remember this one time, just, you know, I had this dream where I was just sort of, my subconscious was working out this incredible fear that I had that they were going to cut me off. And, I remember like going to the beach and with all this frustration and anger, and I was so afraid of being abandoned. I was so afraid of them completely cutting me off. And I remember just like, swimming into the ocean, and I was on my back and just breathing. And I had this sense that God was surrounding me. And, you know, the sense of God's arms upholding me. And it was this real sort of visceral moment where I finally understood that God wasn't over me, judging me, you know, waiting for me to screw up, you know, and God wasn't, you know, this sort of father figure, but God was surrounding me. And as I was floating on the ocean, I just kept thinking about, you know, the John passage where Jesus says that you must be born again. And for anybody who grew up the way we did, you know, we were born again, you know,
and again and again
and again and again.
Every altar call.
Yes, yes. And, you know, I remember just sitting in the pew, you know, when they said, will you be born again? And I would just say, okay, I'm going to do it again. I'm just going to do it again, just in case.
Just in case.
Right. So I just had this sense, finally, this like awakening of, wait a second, our central metaphor is one of giving birth, is an extremely feminine metaphor, is this idea of being birthed by a mother God. And so that was extremely helpful for me to be able to kind of rip away some of those images that I had internalized about God, and you know, just sensing this mother God surrounding me.
You know, one of the things that struck me much, much later than it should have was because that was really ingrained as God is male. And, you know, well, Jesus wouldn't call God Father unless that's pretty key right there, you know, not thinking then, you know, now I know that by Jesus calling God Father, that was one of those like scandalous things to make God a family member like that, because God was this far off, kind of untouchable idea. And that was sort of the scandal that Jesus would even use those types of terms. But for me, I was thinking of God as a man. And in many ways, even when I knew better, I was still doing that. But I think that the shocking thing is that we all know that God is spirit and God doesn't have body parts, like, you know, masculine body parts. But then, you know, that people are using it idolatrously when you just slip in she and you get the looks of abject horror.
If
you slip it in and people are like, you know, the audible gasps, and you're like, oh, is that a problem? And like, and you're like, well, it shouldn't even matter, right? But of course it matters, you know, because that's the baked in, you know, internalized male dominance. And you don't want to, I don't want to be like this person, this female who's like strutting around feminism, and this is what you're doing, you misogynist. But if you really, are digging around, it just has to be a teensy bit under the surface, and you realize this is, it's just baked in really, really obviously. There's a lot of pieces in your book where you talk about the gender issues that people come up with, and a lot of self-loathing that happens. And I know maybe you can talk a little bit about some of your experience and some of the people who have been really, really negatively affected and, you know, pushed away or thought of as dirty when they have taken those things to heart, those gendered, you know, toxic ideas from the church.
Yeah, there's oftentimes we have internalized these theologies, and it's just in our culture, right? It's just we're swimming in it. But for me, a lot of it came with the idea of causing your brother to stumble. So there was always this idea in my culture. When I was growing up, that if you if a man lusted or had an impure thought, then it was on the woman. So I caused my brother to stumble, which is kind of creepy that we use that incest language. but it's whatever. So, but there's that idea, like, oh, okay, well, I'm causing my brother to stumble. And so it was shifting this very natural reaction of lust or attraction or this kind of bodily reaction that humans wouldn't exist unless we had this very primal thing. It shifted it to my responsibility. So I was constantly worried about like what I was wearing. I still do it. It's really hard to break. So very concerned about my own modesty, very concerned about how I was presenting myself to the world. And a lot of us grew up this way. It's in our larger culture. Oftentimes people will talk about it as rape culture. So, you know, it's when a woman gets raped and the first thing they used to ask was, well, what were you wearing? Or that they still do, or, you know, were you drunk or whatever? What did you do that was inappropriate that caused this? So I was really sort of struggling with, you know, where did this come from? Why would we automatically assume this? And you know, it's very prominent within our theology. And it seems like a lot of it came from Augustine. And Augustine was just such a fascinating character. Reading his confessions is just enormously funny and interesting. But in one of his works on the Trinity, he talks about women, and he talks about how women are divided in two parts. There's homo and there's femina. And he was trying to solve this problem in his mind. He believed that women were made in the image of God, but he also was trying to be true to the text that said that women should cover their heads. And so he was trying to figure out like male headship and male authority. And so he was working with that, sorting it all through, and he decided, okay, well, women are two parts. There's homo, and that is the intellectual part of women. And then there's femina, and the femina is sort of our sexual nature, maybe our emotional nature. And he said that the femina needed to be controlled by a man. And so that's why we need male headship. That's why we need to cover our heads. That's why, there's this hierarchy in the Bible. And when I read that, I was like, oh, okay, that makes sense. You know, of course they have to tell us what to wear because, you know, they have to keep our femina in check. And he kind of goes on to say that, like, you know, well, we are made in the image of God as long as, you know, there's this male headship over us that's keeping us in check. And, you know, know, all of that sounds really bizarre, but it is still playing out in our culture and in how we relate to one another in so many ways, both in the church and outside of the church.
Yeah, and it really helps to know who wrote that. He, before he, you know, Lord, make me chaste, but not yet. And
right.
He was really happy to be with a lot of prostitutes and have a son, a bastard son he didn't want to take care of for a while before he decided to be a priest. So I think he was, you know, trying to stave off temptation probably at every turn. And it was women's fault that that happened. You know, I remember going through so many Sunday after Sunday, and we went to church like 3 times a week. Mm-hmm. And I remember hearing so many times, dozens of hundreds of times, about Eve. And, you know, we are all these daughters of Eve, and it, and she in her weakness was deceived and was fooled. And if it wasn't for her and you women, everything would be okay. And, you know, you know, it was very much like, you're the weak link and you tempters. And it was really the onus was on us for a lot of things that went bad in the world. And we were definitely taken aside many times, just like you describe in your book. And, you know, don't cause men to sin. And you have, you know, we were responsible for their impure thoughts and things like that. And it was remarkable at the time. And I felt a lot of shame about that and a lot of really undue guilt. And to think that if something were to happen, it would have been my fault. And when you think about that now, you know, it's no wonder that it was so confusing, and there were so many mixed messages going on, and yet on their end, they could be forgiven for things that, you know, well, you know, their sinning could be overlooked because it really wasn't their fault. You know, so right, it was like, right, kind of like, no wonder you could idolize, or, you know, wonder, like, from until I started liking guys, definitely wanted to be one. I was like, come on, who doesn't want that? I want to be like the top, you know, the top most privileged for sure. And it's no wonder, because being a woman was such a step down in that, you know, religious sect. It's just such a second class status that you really, you know, there's just so much sexism in there that you really are, you're trying to figure it out. You're like, okay, well, you know, and you know that you have to be submissive or you won't be liked by the best guys, right?
Yeah, that's the other thing. I mean, you know, like, basically, now I'm 45, and, you know, I have a sense of what men like. And and we were always told that, you know, if you weren't submissive, if you weren't pure, if you weren't, you know, absolutely charming and loving and beautiful and smiling and, you know, then men wouldn't like you.
Right,
yeah,
right.
Quiet. You never could argue. Mm-hmm. You never could. Yeah. And like, yeah, most men want us to have brains. It's like not attractive to be married to an attractive dead fish.
it's just funny. So yeah, there was just so many things I was reading. I was like, wow, I guess I wasn't the only one. And then, you know, it was really funny too, because plenty of people stayed in the culture and tried to work with it and tried to make it happen. And then plenty of people sort of ditched it and was like, when they had the chance, they were like, yeah, no way. I'm out of here. But then, you know, there's people who, like you say in your book, they don't want to break up with God. They deeply love many, many things about the Christian message, about the way of Jesus. They want to be loved by the divine. And so, you know, how does a person reconcile all those hurts and find a way back into God's loving embrace?
Yeah, I think that's the core of the question as ministers. And I think we're dealing with this in all sorts of situations. I had feedback on my book saying, you know, yeah, it was a great book for people who are coming out of fundamentalism, but progressive churches hurt people too. Like, yeah, that does happen. Yeah. So absolutely. I think, you know, I'm not saying this at all to excuse religion, but as a human construction, I mean, I believe that it's God breathed, but it's made out of humans. You know, as a human construction, there's one thing we know, and that is that we like really mess up and we do terrible things to each other. And we find ways to use our beliefs and our thoughts and our motivations to do terrible things to each other and justify terrible things to each other. My hope, I think, with all of this is, well, how can we begin to identify those terrible things and then be able to hold on to the tradition of loving and abundant and faithful things. So I know, like, if you go to the doctor and you've got a pain, right, they're going to ask you, okay, what are the symptoms? What's going on here? And you probably know this a lot more than I do since you have so much spiritual formation training. But, you know, the doctor will say, okay, what's going on here? What hurts? What are the symptoms? And then they look at the symptoms and they try to figure out the root cause of what's happening in your body. And sometimes it's systemic. Sometimes, you know, your leg is hurting because there's something wrong with some other part of your body. But there's this, you know, you're just trying to get to the core of why there's a problem here. And with the church, so often, you know, somebody will come to us and say, ouch, I'm hurting right here. And we'll say, yeah, you're not really hurting, or, you know, because we don't ever want to get to the root cause. We're so afraid that it's going to, that we need to be defending the church or defending God or defending our beliefs, that we never want to get to that core. And so we end up dismissing those symptoms, or we end up, you know, saying that the person's lying or they're exaggerating or they're, you know, we have a thousand ways of doing this. But I just want to get to the root cause, because there's no way to have a life-giving faith without being able to look at those symptoms and being able to identify those causes. And certainly, you know, progressive churches make mistakes and hurt people. And I, as a minister, have made mistakes and hurt people. So I in no way want to say that, you know, progressive Christianity has figured out everything. but, you know, it has helped me.
Yeah. Well, sometimes for someone to come up and say, I've been hurt, it feels like you're going to have to dismantle a whole bunch of things to make things right. And that's going to be this enormous task. But even just acknowledging that the pain is real and coming alongside somebody, I mean, that's kind of what spiritual direction is. You know, you're coming alongside somebody and you're not fixing something, and you're just valuing them, and you're truly journeying with them, and that they know that they're not all alone makes a big difference. But if you're right, if you feel like it's a threat somehow, like you did something wrong and you're the reason I'm broken, then it's handled so differently. You know, if it's a big deal, you know, there's a cover up where, you know, sometimes things are handled that way institutionally.
Yeah, it's interesting because right now I'm kind of in this public conversation about complementarianism. And basically, you know, I'm a feminist. I've been a feminist for a long time. So I don't believe in women. I don't believe in women ceding their autonomy in their own home. I mean, certainly marriages are definitely a give and take. There's no question about that. But there should be equality as you're making these decisions. But there, right now, there's this conversation where a lot of complementarianists. Is that what they're called?
You know, ship you're asking guys. Me. Complementarians? Well, yeah, you know, maybe you we go. Should there define that sense. In case people don't know, because this isn't a Christian show.
Ah, yeah. Okay, good. Thank you. Thank
Surprise.
You. Sorry. Yeah, so... So there are a lot of people who believe in male headship in the home, and that men should ultimately be the tiebreaker and women should submit any authority over to a male. And so, you know, it's just something I don't believe in. Right now I'm in the midst of a public discussion about that. And I believe that some people look at that and they see me as attacking the church by saying that, and they've become very defensive about that, and it's just fascinating to kind of see that reaction. You can just take that all out if you want.
that's fine. I think like when people who are not, it's a little bit of insider baseball it unless is. You are part of the conversation and have known about it. Like since my dad was a minister, I'm like, yeah, totally get it. And I remember asking my dad, I was a little girl, I was like 7. And I said, why, you know, women wear pants, but like guys, men don't wear dresses. Why? And he goes, I kid you not. He goes, that's because they would be coming down to women's levels if they wore dresses. And women are less than men. And I was like, oh, okay. You know, so it was like, okay. And
your daughter.
Yeah, I was like, okay, that's how it is. I understand. I wish I was a man. Of course. I'm like, yeah. So anyway, but yeah, I think that what we think of that the Bible, well, in certain circles, the Bible isn't as if the Bible is just standalone. It can go for all times, not realizing that it was written by people in a certain culture. And then it's also interpreted by people in a certain culture. And now, and as women gain more autonomy, then all of a sudden it's okay. Like you were not burned at the stake and you're a minister. I mean, yeah. how weird is that? You should have been burned at the stake ages ago, Carol.
I'm totally going to quote you.
You probably feel safe in your own home and everything. So obviously, the scriptures have been interpreted differently in the last few hundred years. And you can remain safe in your own home and things are being interpreted differently, but yet certain other passages are still being interpreted as if they were, you know, just the same way and as they were in, you know, early, you know, Palestine 2000 years ago. And so it's kind of like, well, we're going to take this and we're going to say it means this, but other things we're going to say means this. It depends on how things are being interpreted as to, you know, which group says what. And I always think that the whole complementarian egalitarian thing is still an old wineskins kind of thing. To me, it's like you're almost, even by using those terms to me, and I can say this because I'm not a pastor and I'll have to worry about losing a church or anything like that. I'm just like yelling from the outside. But to me, it's like even using those terms makes you part of an old argument. It makes you putting you in categories that deserve to be blown up. And mm-hmm. I don't feel like it's useful to do it. It's more useful to say, those arguments don't work anymore, mainly because they don't make any sense. And it just, either it's neither male nor female, or it isn't.
Either
we're all equal or we're not. But it's really difficult because if you look at our society, of course we're not all equal. Women aren't paid the same as men for doing the same work. So we know that that's actually not how things really are. We can hope for that. That can be the telos, that can be the aim, but it's not how things really are. So we hope for that, but I'm not sure that we get there. You know, I'm not sure that we ever get there, but we're hoping. And I think it's hard because reality doesn't mesh with what is supposed to happen. And so in terms of the things you deal with and with men and women and equality and people having those ideas and having been hurt by those ideas, how have you helped them reconcile some of those?
Well, there's a lot of ways to do it. There's a lot of healing in some of our practices. And, you know, at one point in my book, I talk about it feels like going to the enemy's encampment to steal Band-Aids. But there is a sense of you have to begin to, for many of us who are spiritually oriented, we go to meditation and we go to prayer, and many of these exercises really rewire our brains. You know, they help us to imagine God in a different way. And when we imagine God in a different way, it can affect us neurologically. So it's really interesting, people who do these, you know, the brain work, neurologists, they can look at the brain, and when a person believes in a vengeful God, a God who is judgmental and angry and violent, then it's reflected in their brains, like the amygdala is constantly, you know, is enlarged and is exercised a lot. But if we are able to pray and meditate on a loving God, a God who is for us, then it allows us to change that brain chemistry, and we actually become more loving and peaceful people. So doing that is with prayer, is with meditation, is with singing songs. Oftentimes we need to construct a new metaphor of God. So if our metaphor of God is Father and that doesn't make sense to us, then we can think of another one. Or if it's warrior and it doesn't make sense to us, then we can begin to imagine another one. But both identifying those metaphors, because sometimes they're so internal that we don't even know what they are, and being able to construct something else, being able to understand that there's something, that there's another metaphor that we can use. And the beautiful thing about the Bible is that it's filled with metaphors. You know, there's lots and lots of metaphors about God, and we are incredible metaphors throughout history. So tradition and history, and so it's not difficult to be able to find a really life-giving metaphor. So I think that's going to be just very important for us to be able to hold on to and be able to do when you're doing this work.
Now, because your book has so many pieces to it that are exercises and really digging deep, do you think people should do it alone or do it with a counselor or a friend? Or do you think it's better that they don't do it all by themselves?
Oftentimes, it helps to get an outside perspective. That's One of the many reasons why I think, you know, having a group, some sort of faith community or worshiping community is helpful. Some people can't go back into church. It's just too painful for them. But oftentimes if we can, then that can be very helpful. Mainly just because you can have somebody who is a corrective, a mirror, someone who can tell us exactly what we're doing and what we're just can mirror back to us. So that's always helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or just a friend or spiritual director too isn't a person who will, anywhere you are, even if you're an atheist, it doesn't, they just meet you where you are.
Yeah.
Yeah, as I was reading it and I was like, triggering is too harsh of a word probably because I've done counseling and things like that, but I was reading it and I was like, you know, because I was reading it quickly and I was like, I'm going to go back and I'm going to do some of the exercises, but I bet I'm going to have plenty of time and talk to somebody because you wind up digging deep with them and it, in a good way, but also in a way that can bring up old things you forgot were there.
Yeah, it is. It's difficult work and it's important work.
You know, one of the reasons why I wanted you on, which will seem obvious when I say it, but is that we should all be working toward healing. And we all, I'm sure, have some kind of wounds from church or someone who's hurt us through a faith community. I mean, everybody has been betrayed in some way or hurt some way that maybe they've associated with the church or with God, even mm-hmm. if it's something small, because people make mistakes and we don't get our theology just right. And we probably mm-hmm. hurt people too. And so hopefully this book, along with continuing our journey and our search, will put us in the right direction toward healing and connecting with others in a richer way. And I don't know if you have any other final words of wisdom for us, Carol, but this is your big chance.
Well, no, I just want to thank you for your work. I know doing a podcast is no easy task. And so I always really appreciate people who delve into this. So thank you.
Sure. And where can people find you on your social media or your website?
Yeah, I have a website, carolhowardmerritt.org. My Twitter is @CarolHoward, and my Facebook is Carol Howard Merritt. And I'm usually pretty responsive if I can be. So yeah, feel free to tweet and I'm happy to chat. That's how Lisa and I got connected, right?
That's right. Yeah. So this has been great. Thank you so much.
Oh, well, thank you. I really appreciate it.
If you've listened to the show and you've thought, wow, I wish I could find out a little bit more about someone mentioned or a book or a website, that's what show notes are for. I've created an all-access pass, and you can access the access pass for just $1. It unlocks all show note episodes, too. It's a reoccurring $1 a month, and you can cancel at any time. Just go to patreon.com/sparkmymuse. Patreon is like patron with an E. patreon.com/sparkmymuse. Remember to subscribe to the show on iTunes or your podcast app, and I invite you to sign up for my newsletter at sparkmymuse.com. I try to send out a message once or twice a month. If you enjoyed the show, please rate it on iTunes. Thank you so much for listening.